I think the only thing, and we're, you know, we all get tripped up, and we're, if I had to preach, and I try not to preach, is just be, you know, George Harrison nailed it so early with beware of darkness, and just, it's so subtle sometimes. Keep the negativity, keep the doubt, keep the fear, all these subtle signs of, you know, one unkind word. Because you perceive someone just attacked you verbally. Mm-hmm. If you can just, you know, and I'm trying really hard to just recognize where I still have, you know, a lot of work to do there, and just keep stripping away the veneer from, you know, those things that are not allowing, you know, these higher frequencies to, you know, maintain themselves consistently.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and welcome to In Search of the New Compassionate Male. I am the producer, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay. Would you introduce our guest today?
Absolutely. Hi, Dennis. Today we have Rick Craniac. And Rick, I want to say hi to you first off.
Good afternoon.
It's so good to have you with us. We had a conversation the other day, and it was brief, but it so energized me. What comes to mind is, you know, you've got years of experience as an international investor and entrepreneur. And what I want to learn from your vantage point is, you know, what's happening in the world as it relates to men and compassion from a macro level, you know, with all the turmoil going on. And I'm not going to go into that, but what's the story that's not being told? What's happening in the boardrooms? You know, what are the investors doing? What are the entrepreneurs doing? How does compassion play into all that at the top level? That's kind of where I'm going. So I'd love to get your thoughts.
Okay. Well, boy, that's an all-encompassing question. So
pick it up anywhere you want.
Exactly. We take any bite, a bite of it, any place you wish, and dig in and help us to explore.
Yeah. And then I think the next question based on that is probably going to be, you're going to ask me, what's the meaning of life?
Exactly.
Well, you read our script.
Did you send him the script in advance?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, I think, you know, from my experience, and I won't bore you with, you know, all of it and how I got to where I am, but I think at the boardroom now, it's at three levels. If you take a company like one of the automotive companies here in Detroit that I won't name, they have an annual allotment for charitable contributions. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, hopefully it'll increase every year. And it's just a matter of an allocation. And it's a real corporate decision. And usually it's like, you know, this charity got $20 million from us last year, and they're asking for $30 million. And they're almost like divvying up the, you know, the spoils mm-hmm. of war and who's going to get what. So that's they're doing good. And I'm sure they know something about the charities that they're, you know, donating to, and they've been vetted and, you know, all this and that. So that's like one level. I think mm-hmm. the next level is someone that is a founder of, you know, a more socially responsible mindset with the company. And I always think of, you know, Patagonia and all the usual suspects that we read about, where they're just passionate about, you know, the case of Patagonia, you know, it's keeping land pristine and unspoiled. And he bought God knows how many millions of acres in Argentina. And, mm-hmm. you know, so that's really at the other end of the spectrum. And then I think, you know, it kind of kicks in between that, and you have kind of a hybrid model where someone within the company champions a cause, and mm-hmm. it can be from, you know, a product development. So back here in Detroit, automotive capital of the world still, you know, there's all these new technologies for, you know, clean batteries, electric cars, hybrids, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, from that, you know, innovation in technology then ends up somehow with charitable contributions. So it's, you know, we saw how the internet was unequal between People of affluence and minorities in inner cities. So, you know, maybe the next time around that leads to, we're going to do this differently. We're working with the city of Detroit. We're going to make sure that we donate money so there's, 1,000 charging stations in, Metro Detroit. So it can kind of swirl around in a lot of different ways. But I think overall, where I'm encouraged is that despite, all the, negative things you read about of executives and corporate behavior, that there's still a lot of goodwill that's increasing. And people are at least thinking about these things where before, yes. They weren't even thought of. You know, it's just top line, bottom line, politics.
Yep. Boards, well, we sure don't see that on the news, do we?
No. Well, the news goes back, and since this is Freeform, there was a media professor at the high school. I went to parochial school, but the high school next to me, Dearborn High School, home of Ford Motor Company, Russ Gibb, who ended up having the ballroom in town that, the Who and Cream and all these legendary bands performed at, he taught his students that there was a negative bias with the media. Now, this is in 1968. And so to prove it to them, one day in journalism class, they found the three local news, stations, the CBS, NBC, and ABC affiliate, and just said that, in a heroic act, an old lady tripped and a boy lunged and got her out of death's way from a car coming by. And no one came up to cover the story. And the next time, and they put some interval into it, so it didn't seem like a setup, they just said there's a horrible collision with, multiple vehicles, and they don't know how many are dead, and blah, blah, blah. And every news station showed up with videos and cameras to film it.
Ah.
So this negative bias on the media, it's changed, but it seems like it's been around, that was 52 years ago. So it's new. It seems more painful now, I think, than it used to be, because it used to be, a homicide or shooting or this or that. And now it's, things way deeper and into the bowels of our American government and, foreign espionage. We've seen this last week, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, we've learned, Rick, the thing is that I think that happening outside of the Cro-Magnon's cave, one guy hitting another guy on the head got more attention than one guy taking a basket of fruit over to another guy. But yet we know which one is more constructive. So that if it's built upon our internal human structure, we're having to go to a higher level of consciousness. And I really love what you talked about the bottom line, because it appears to me that there is something in conscious capitalism that the in the corporate boardrooms that I've been in or that I've been experiencing, that they're talking more about both the social contract and how do we be good corporate citizens. Are you hearing that in your experience?
Yeah, as good corporate citizens, yes. And so that has a different context too. And in our city in Detroit, that means that the major companies, which would be the utilities, Detroit Edison, Consumer Power, the three car companies, General Motors, Ford, and Daimler, Fiat, Chrysler, they work with the mayor and with the city to try and, partner on programs or, get feedback. The crime rate went down here drastically by just putting in more lighting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's not rocket science all the time. It doesn't have to be, Silicon Valley technology. But then let me flip over, because you're using the term corporate boardrooms. Mm-hmm. So who owns a lot of the big companies in America or the majority shareholders? And if you flip that moniker over to family offices, which a family office is defined as disposable wealth to invest or donate, by the lowest common denominator, it's $5 million. a more relevant statistic is there's last, and this is probably 5 years old, and with the stock market appreciation, all these new unicorns, it's changed. But there were 60,000 families of disposable wealth to invest or donate of over $50 million in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So you have this different gene pool than corporations, which are families that have, you know, accumulated wealth through their shares, that have that at their disposal. And, you know, I've had the privilege to work within the family office side of the equation. And I can tell you that the philanthropy there is just like going through the roof, and it's different with every family. It can go from, you know, and I won't name the families, but at my healthcare forums, we had two prominent New York families, both household names, and one had heart disease in the family. So they were, you know, donating and investing and writing grants and everything in between in heart technologies and solutions and nonprofits. And the other had a seven-year-old that was type 1 diabetic, which is very unusual. And so he disposed of his grandmother, who was deceased, $4 billion of real estate assets, and started you know, a series of funds and grant. Well, actually, it's public knowledge. So it's the Hemsley family, you know, Leona Hemsley, sure, grandmother. And so he's all over everything diabetic, and there's got to be a better way, whether it's to manage current diabetics or get better insulin or better treatment or monitoring. So we're seeing a lot of that in these family offices. It's very interesting, and it's very encouraging. And I'm, again, involved with Cavendish Global, that we have these, they're now online events, but we had done 30 events that match, you know, unmet needs in medical with wealthy investors and wealthy donors. So I've had the ability to really kind of observe and learn through the last 5.5 years with this.
Have you noticed a change, Rick? Have you noticed a difference in not just in them, but also in yourself over these last 10 years, over these last years? I know both Clay and I experienced from outside the George Floyd murder, and so it really called us to dig deep into our own conscious and unconscious biases where race is concerned. And I know Detroit has such an iconic African-American population, and it has, and it also has this beautiful architecture that has been put in the 30s and 40s, 20s and 30s and 40s, that is there, that is waiting to be restored like extraordinary. I mean, the infrastructure is amazing. Detroit's an extraordinary place.
Well, just so I'll tackle three things at once. So the two sides of the coin, I was in the Detroit riots in 1968. I was a senior in high school, and I was a car nut. And we had these wraparound screens back then called the Cineramas. So they were like 270-degree screens. Mm-hmm. And so we went to see Grand Prix, which was over there on a Sunday afternoon after church. And coming out, we couldn't figure out why there were so many fires and so much smoke in the air. And we were like a mile from the riots on three sides. And then we drove back into our, you know, secure alcove suburb of Dearborn, Michigan, where Ford Motor Company is. And, you know, there are state police at the border between Detroit and Dearborn. And, you know, it was really tragic because, you know, the Black community burned a lot of their own businesses and hurt their own, you know, in the middle of that summer. But ironically enough, the other side of the coin back in that era is the Black community here, because a rising boat lifts all tides, maybe not equally, but it still lifts all tides. We had the first large emerging Black middle class in America here.
Yes.
Came out of manufacturing and automotive and all the byproducts of it. So, you know, I've kind of watched race from being raised in a, you know, suburb where, you know, it was just three ethnic groups, Italian, Irish and Polish. And I met my first Jew my freshman year of college, and my first Black person working at the post office my senior year in high school. And so I was really sheltered from all this, you know, and so it just, it you grow up in it and you don't even realize that you've been raised in a subtle subconscious, you know, a community that in and by itself is somewhat racist if, you know, people
aren't. Systemically so.
Yeah. And so, you know, we've gone through all that. And then, you know, being in the music business for 20 some years, I got more than my chance to get to know a lot of Black artists firsthand. So I went through that whole phase. And I think now I'm involved in a project which I really can't get into, but it involves, you know, bringing the equality barrier up for access and healthcare for Black Americans. And it's through my nonprofit that I work with, American Impact Capital. So I've kind of like seen it, you know, from a lot of different lenses. And I think that we're really in a point now where, you know, there's no turning back. You know, it's almost like the civil rights marches in the 60s led to legislation. And then states that weren't crazy about Johnson's legislation figured out a way to roll it back and cut benefits and do this and that. So and now, you know, it took a lot of tragedies and police brutality in a lot of cities, certainly with Chicago in the spotlight even today. You know, they just did another wrongful murder charge and awarded a family $11 million. So this cash-strapped, you know, city has paid out, I think, $190 million in wrongful death in the last decade. And a lot of that money comes out of the education budget, you know? So when you look at it through that lens, it's like, you know, how can this keep going on, you know?
I know, I exactly. And so where do you see the opportunity in your work? Because one of the things we are is in search of the new compassionate male. We're both looking for compassion as an active noun, that we can actually do it and use it in this. Can you talk about it in your own life, Rick, and your own growth from that kid in Dearborn who comes out of the Cinerama and sees the riots to here, and the work of compassion and what that means in your own life?
Well, mine's really simple. You know, in the morning I asked Spirit to just guide me with what I'm supposed to do and who I can help, and for me to have the wisdom to pay attention so something doesn't have to hit me over the head like a baseball bat. And then I just react every day, and it's amazing the people that come into my life, and I'm open-minded to all of them with a reason that they're there, and I just try and figure it out. That's simple.
That is profound. But to get to that type of simplicity, Rick, you have to go down many, many levels, because we have this, we have these biases, we have the media, we have so much to be able to get down to that, to get down to that level of wisdom.
Yeah, I try to not tune into the media other than to understand the headlines, for being just that, the headlines, other than areas of interest for myself. So I try and ignore it as much as humanly possible.
I'm just envisioning this incredible, invisible network of good men out there, good people, that are diligently working behind the scenes for the greater good. And I'm always just astonished that none of that really surfaces, other than at the end of NPR, there's, you know, some foundation mentioned or something like that.
I think, you know, a lot of people, this is the first thing I've done publicly. You know, a lot of people don't talk about what they do. They just go do it. You know, I think that that's the first component about it. And then I think, you know, like energy attracts itself. So then as people that are like-minded meet each other and interact with each other, then you get to this collaborative effort where you learn, share, And just, take those seeds and germinate as many of them as you possibly can. And, you get smarter as you go. And I think you get a little more intuitive as you go.
Where did you, at what point in life did that become apparent for you, that you really embraced that?
That's a rough one. So I had a lot of success. When I was 46, I got squeezed out of the company I founded. We were the main concert promoter in Detroit and Broadway show promoter in Michigan. And we'd done some national tours. So I went from, one day, promoting the Rolling Stones and Madonna to the next day being squeezed out of my company and having a $550,000 two-year trial to settle for my equity. And it was a real humbling event, to say the least. And I had walked into a health food store to get some B12 for stress. And there's a long-haired guy that checked me out, and I paid cash, so he couldn't have known my name. And I said, "Well, thank you very much." And he says, "You're welcome, Rick." And then I said, "I'm sorry, I don't remember where I know you from." And he was the one that got my spiritual path opened up. And so it started there, and then it was around reading first, because I've always been more of the mind than being good at, clearing my head and just going into a 10-minute meditative, state without wandering. And so it started with reading and the intellectual side of metaphysics and all this other, material. And then, more people just started coming into my life. We had the privilege to go to a lot of third world countries, and I got a chance to see how people lived. And so my wife and my two boys, we would do charitable work where we just wouldn't leave a check. We'd get hands-on. So if the orphanage needed 400 pair of shoes for the kids in India, we'd go to the wholesaler and find, 22 pairs of size 3 and 42. So we really got down and dirty with all this. And whether it be that or a water well in Mali or bicycles in the mountainous areas of Uganda so they could get AIDS medication up to patients that weren't strong enough to do the walk every day. We just got a real empathy. And that's when I was asked to become a member of Cavendish Global. And so I thought, okay, instead of just what I can donate to my Christian microloan organization, if I can meet these wealthy families and I turn them on to these things, I can, again, back to my promoting days from the concerts, now I'm promoting charities, and I can get more people to the table. And it did, we're on the Christian microloans. I met a billionaire from the Dakotas, and he actually wrote a really big check. I got Opportunities International come to one of our conferences, and so it worked at times. And it's just been a journey then, and a lot with Cavendish, we had a lot of people on the impact side, and we had a sister nonprofit organization. And so, you just keep, putting more, relationships in your life, and you just grow as it evolves. You never know exactly where the road's going to take you.
That's the truth. you said something earlier, about, getting down in there, in finding the shoes and getting them over to India and so forth. That reminds me, Dennis, of our conversations with Karambu.
Yes.
In Kenya, she said, it's colonialism to write a check and throw it over the water to us here. And she said this, and I have to say it right. She said, "I don't want your money. I want a partner."
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you're doing. That's exactly. And
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and it is. Even with that, we're still seen as colonials when we go to these, countries. It's just hard, when someone gets a donation from America and their old T-shirts, and maybe there's, a little rip in one, and then they see people in, nice polished, REI Patagonia type clothes. It's obvious to them, you know, that,
of course.
And so you just have to be really subtle and, you know, really downplay the way you're dressed, and you want them to feel comfortable with you. You learn the language. We've had some god-awful food, but you never want to offend anyone. I remember drinking horse milk, warm horse milk in Mongolia. We were invited into a yurt, and the woman went out and milked the horse, and, you know, we were expected to drink the milk. It was that simple, you know?
Yep.
Mother mare's milk, that's what it was called.
You know, that reminds me, that takes me back to childhood. I remember as a kid, Dad would, you know, he worked in Lesotho or in Botswana. They lived there. They, you know, he was over in Syria and so forth. And he said, Clay, you know, you've got to study before you go there. You need to understand the history.
Oh yeah. That's
before
true.
You go in there, because, you know, he would say some of these guys come down there like they've got the answer and they don't ask any questions.
Yeah.
And they waltz in and say, here's the program. And then they waltz out and nothing's changed.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And, you know, whenever I have a ritual, I stay very busy. So, you know, the airplane ride over, whatever travel book we have, you know, the first 40 pages are usually the history of the country. And so, you know, I read up on it to make sure I know as much as possible, even though it's still at a real, you know, pop level. So it is helpful.
Yeah.
I have a, you know, Rick, it is so, this is a time when we can go from zero to making a difference so much faster. I think that's one of the positive things of social media that can help us to know where can we make a difference. And it always comes from my being able to look at you as a human being, not as a human doing. And making sure, and it's not your rate, your rank, or your wealth, or what, it's who you are as a human being and what you're doing here on the planet. That's what you did, Clay, when you went over to Corambus and you did that men's group. I mean, this.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was spontaneous, and I think Dad was channeling through me, because I looked at those young fellows there and I said, you know, who do I think I am, a privileged white Western male, to come over here and think that I can teach you anything? You know, I'm here to learn and to share, and perhaps together we can both come out at a higher level than we came into this. And I didn't prepare that. But it's what came out when we opened up the our retreat, and that was the key. And I learned so much. I absolutely brought so much back, and I feel like I left some too.
I one of the things in my life, and I'm 72 this year, Rick, and Clay's in his mid 60s. And one of the things I've learned is that there's no such thing as a one way blessing, that if it were, the universe would spin out of control, that I had better get as much out of an encounter that I am than the person who is receiving, or there's something wrong with my receptors.
Well, and again, you know, the Native American culture is about giving. And I've been reading a lot of Native American books on holy men and medicine men. I think it's Fool's Crow. Someone visited him and admired his turquoise necklace, and so he just took it off and gave it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And there was never anything expected in return. No. This, you know, this means more to him than it does to me, so he should have it. And that's really kind of the epitome of, you know, caring enough about the other person and wanting to make them happy and share and everything else, you know. And I think the sharing aspect, you know, we've forgiven, you know, a lot of these things are really etched in stone from a long time ago. You know, the tithing, the 10%, there's a lot of history in, you know, the Kabbalah for Jews and in Christian writings. And, you know, it just kind of, we've got more money than ever now, and we kind of forgot about that.
Rick, what is you are currently in 2021? Here we are in December of 2020 and going into 2021. What are you curious about? What are the things that you're exploring both within Rick right now and also in the world, the things that you're curious and interested about?
I think, let me do the second question first. What I'm really curious about is, you know, how many lessons we learned through COVID. And it really is a spiritual reckoning. It's not just a virus. It's much, much, much more than that.
Beautiful.
And
said.
I think the jury is still out on that. There's a couple of alarming statistics. You know, one, you know, a lot of people believe the next pandemic is not going to be a virus. It's going to be, you know, a behavioral health pandemic. And certainly the numbers on any of the stats around, you know, increase in alcohol, you know, spousal incidents. It's not healthy so far, and it is way different. But yet out of that, I think I'm real curious to see if all these lessons are learned the, you know, I won't say the easy way because it's been hard, but the easy way going forward to just kind of like streamline, you know, that that process going forward. So that's one of the things I'm really curious about in the year in 2021, more than anything else. And in terms of, you know, what I'm looking at is just, you know, how can I leverage some of the relationships that I have and really make 1 + 1 = 10 with energy, you know, whether it's connecting the right people together that I haven't connected yet, because I've been blessed with an enormous network and Rolodex. So over the holidays, I'm going to be reflecting on that a bit. And other than that, I think it's just really, right in between you two gentlemen in age, leaning on the higher side. And so it's just really about keeping myself healthy for longevity so I can just keep doing this work as long as possible.
And what's on the minds of your sons? How did you, when you look at them and you look at 18-year-old Rick and then, you know, the journey where your consciousness was in relation to where their consciousness is, can you see a shift, a delta there?
Yeah, it's huge. My oldest is an attorney, very interested in Native American rights and environmental. In between college and law school, he taught on a reservation in the middle of nowhere, Mission, South Dakota. And he, there's a program called Teach for America where they take college graduates and they put them in underprivileged areas that are difficult, that a lot of times don't get the best teachers. So he did 2 years there, and I would have never given up 2 years of my life for, you know, the minuscule pay that they pay them to do work like that. And my youngest one, after college, went into the Peace Corps in Rwanda for 2 years. So, you know, right there, you know, words are easy, but, you know, to give up a chunk of your life at that age kind of says it all. And so I think that the millennials are really ahead. It's not just about my sons. The stats are that they give 97% of millennials donate to some charity during the course of a year. And I forget the percentage that volunteer, but it's a very high percentage. So whether it's a pet shelter or with my oldest, he's, you know, at a homeless shelter for teenagers that are kicked out of the house or have an abusive parent or this or that. So they're really, you know, walking the walk and not talking the talk from what I can tell. And I think they get mislabeled because a lot of times, you know, they just get labeled that they don't have the social skills, you know, because they're too wrapped up in, you know, electronics, whether it's a video game or the internet or social media or their phones, or they get labeled that they're not as ambitious and they want things handed to them. You know, in our generation was, you know, you eat what you kill. You know, there wasn't anything at least handed to me along the way. I had to work for every, you know, scrap of meat that I earned. So I think I'm very encouraged that, you know, we're going to be in a better place and they won't let the world go back to the way that we let it evolve here, you know, certainly environmentally, if nothing else.
Well, I love how you say that, Rick, because it brings us back to what you were talking about earlier, about how in the media, we don't get a chance to talk or celebrate what's going right. Now, what you just gave us was a perspective from a familial going on out, but the story that you're telling is the story that is happening all over. It's just not getting the press.
Correct.
It's not getting, and this is why I'm so glad that you brought this up, Rick, because this is a way we can help magnify and amplify the signal. Because if you don't amplify the signal, as we know from music or from media, if you don't amplify it, it stays below the level of understanding to everybody.
I think, you know, to add to that, you know, whatever mistakes, you know, I've certainly made in my lives and others, and I was told not to use the word mistake. Whatever lessons I did not learn in my life earlier, I think, you know, we can see where the kids are learning these lessons, you know, at an earlier age than we did.
Yes.
And so that's encouraging. It isn't encouraging.
They've got such a more complex world that they're coming into. And I think there are a lot of star children out there.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to get too cosmic, but I could not agree with you more.
Go
I'm
there.
So glad. Yeah, please, because that's, we're both seeing that in our lives, Rick, that whatever we pay attention to grows. There is some relation between what I observe and what changes. And so therefore, what I pay attention to is very important. And that is a metaphysical principle that undergirds every metaphysical thought movement or book or person that I've ever studied. Well,
so, you know, 30 years ago, this would have been considered, you know, theoretical. And then with all the advances in quantum physics, we know that now. You know, the water work of, you know, the gentleman in Japan where he put a snowflake under a microscope and with the one he told how beautiful it was and how much he loved it. And it actually changed its form to something much more eye appealing. And then he swore at the other one and told it had no value and it was a waste of space. I mean, every and you could see this thing deform to where it looked like, you know, a bacteria or a microscope, a virus under a microscope. So, you know, it's this stuff has been proved now scientifically. It doesn't just have to be, you know, theoretical model before. But I would highly recommend to anybody that they go to eraofpeace.org and take a look at some of the vlogs. Patricia Cody Robel's been connecting light workers around the world since before the internet. And she probably has 3 million people that are, you know, like-minded in days like yesterday are unison and, you know, magnifying that synchronicity back to, you know, 100 people, you know, praying and doing visions of light. Has the power of, you know, God knows how many dark efforts or energies or intent. And so that's one of the reasons I'm really encouraged now. I think that beyond the headlines, you know, we've crossed the chasm. And, you know, the reason it feels so bad as part of the transformation is all this horrible stuff that's been kept under the covers has to surface to transmute.
So true.
That's wonderful. And it's and I love your perspective, Rick, because one of the things that I don't that I work to keep my understanding is that I don't know the twists and the turns, and they're going to be twists and turns, and not to take that so seriously, but just to continue to go down the road, continue this process.
Yeah.
You know, and the, I want to add to that is we never know the impact that we're making.
No.
You know, it's, I'm talking to one person and making a point, and somebody that I don't see walks by and they pick up two words.
Right.
And their life has changed.
Yeah. It's back to that Ray Bradbury book whose name escapes me on how you touching a butterfly.
Yeah.
South America affects the trade winds, you know.
Exactly, and the chaos. And do you? I'm seeing a lot of study in field theory that we're actually that we carry around fields. Like before radios were invented, we had radio waves. Radio waves are part of the background of the universe. But this field theory that we carry around that we actually can raise the vibration of the consciousness of our by raising the field within our own conscious. Are you hearing anything about that, Richard?
Yeah, and I've had the privilege again to someone approach me because they read my aura and wanted to figure out who I was, to, you know, someone that has recorded a CD in Mammoth Caves with the Dalai Lama. So I've seen probably 10 variations on how people have, you know, raised their own frequency. You know, it can be much simpler than that. It doesn't have to be the Dalai Lama in a cave. It can be just going into, you know, silent meditation for a couple of minutes, you know. So we don't have to be, you know, so eclectic with this. And I think that's where I started, is I was so impressed with sensationalism. And when I was 22, you know, Edgar Casey in Atlantis, oh my gosh, how could he see what Atlantis was like and look backwards, you know, 9,000 years. And yes, yeah, so I went from that into settling down to the simple is just wonderful. And, you know, when you get to, you know, the occasional roller coaster ride and you're driven to a point that you want to keep your seatbelt on, that's cool and it's exciting and it's invigorating, but then you go back to simple breath again.
That's wonderful. Rick, I thank you for joining us today. Is there anything we haven't talked about that's on your mind or on your heart here before the end of the show that we want to make sure and get an opportunity to speak?
No, I think the only thing, and we're, you know, we all get tripped up, and we're, if I had to preach, and I try not to preach, is just be, you know, George Harrison nailed it so early with beware of darkness, and just, it's so subtle sometimes. Keep the negativity, keep the doubt, keep the fear, all these subtle signs of, you know, one unkind word, because you perceive someone just attacked you verbally. Mm-hmm. If you can just, you know, and I'm trying really hard to just recognize where I still have, you know, a lot of work to do there, and just keep stripping away the veneer from, you know, those things that are not allowing, you know, these higher frequencies to, you know, maintain themselves consistently. You know, this stuff has been building now, and we're, you know, yesterday we hit a crescendo.
Yeah.
And now our fifth dimensional crystalline DNA and RNA, if we just reiterate our purpose, you know, it's like, you know, rocket fuel now, and it's divine feminine energy, and it's, you know, we really can, you know, co-create. You know, it's up to us what we want to create. And before it was harder, and now it's going to be a lot easier, I believe.
What a beautiful benediction for all of us.
Amen.
Rick Craniac, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, this is my pleasure. I love what you're doing, and we'll look forward to helping in any way I can.
So well, appreciate that.
We and the rest of the world. Thank you, everyone. Okay. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Clay. And thank you for everyone for joining us on this episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male. We will see you next time.